Welcome to Silence the Mind Cluck. I'm your host, Maria T. Finch, and I'm super glad that you're here. Get ready to quiet that mind and reap the rewards.
Okay, good morning. Welcome, everyone. I'm so happy today to have Terry Tucker with me. Terry, welcome.
Thanks, Maria. I'm looking forward to talking with you.
Yeah, totally. So please introduce yourself.
Yeah, I don't know where to start. I'm old, so this could take a few minutes. But
that's okay. You're not
I was born and raised on the south side of Chicago. I'm the oldest of three boys. You can't tell this from my voice or from looking at me, but I'm 6'8" tall.
Wow. And
I stopped smoking when I was three is kind of always my joke when people learn that I'm that tall. I was always been playing basketball. I played basketball all the way up through college. I attended college at the Citadel, which is a military college in Charleston, South Carolina. And then after I graduated, I moved home to find a job. I'm really kind of going to date myself now, but this was long before the internet was available. And I was the first person in my family to graduate from college. So I was kind of all set to make my mark on the world with my newly obtained business administration degree. And I look back now and realize just how little I knew about business just because I had a degree. Yes. Fortunately, I was able to find that first job in the marketing department at the corporate headquarters of Wendy's International, the hamburger chain.
Sure.
Unfortunately, I lived with my parents for the next 3.5 years as I helped my mom care for my father and my grandmother, who were both dying of different forms of cancer.
Wow.
Professionally, as I said, started out at Wendy's, then became a hospital administrator. Then I made a major pivot in my life and became a police officer. And part of being a police officer was I was an undercover narcotics investigator. I was also a SWAT team hostage negotiator. Wow. Then I started my own school security consulting business. I coached girls' high school basketball. I made the brilliant business decision to start a motivational speaking business right in the middle of the pandemic, which kind of had to morph into things like this, like podcasts. Published my first book in 2020, but for the last 10 years or so, I've been dealing with a rare form of cancer. And then I guess finally to round it out, my wife and I have been married for almost 29 years. We have one child, a daughter, who's a graduate of the United States Air Force Academy and is an officer in the new branch of the military, the Space Force.
Wow. Okay. Wow. That is really a fascinating history. And I like that you changed different jobs, and I'm guessing you kind of gathered skills and learned things about yourself in each of them. That's amazing. Well, so let's start with, tell me about the ways that your own mind chatter, your mind cluck has challenged you. And I can imagine there have been different circumstances around that. And let's just start there, and you can pick whichever topic you'd like to begin with.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, I was a basketball player, you know, most of my young life. And when I was in high school, I had a couple knee surgeries. And I remember when I went back playing basketball after those knee surgeries, my brain was putting all kinds of negative thoughts into my mind, you know, things like, hey, you're probably a step slower since these surgeries, and college coaches aren't going to be interested in recruiting you. And I remember thinking, wait a minute, I'm still playing at an elite level, and college coaches are still reaching out about the possibility of playing for their college or their university. I realized that I had to change the narrative of those negative thoughts that my brain was putting into my mind. And, you know, if you think about it, our brains are, they're hardwired to avoid pain and discomfort and to seek pleasure. So to the brain, the status quo, the way things are right now, is comfortable and familiar and should just be left alone. The problem with that is the only way that we're going to grow, the only way we're going to get better, the only way we're going to improve is if we step outside those comfort zones and do things that make us uncomfortable. When I was coaching high school basketball, I used to constantly remind my players that they needed to become comfortable with being uncomfortable. So your brain knows, you know, your fears, your vulnerabilities, your weaknesses, and it will use those against you anytime you want to step outside that comfort zone and do things that scare you a little bit.
Yeah, that is so true. So I would love to talk about your cancer experience, because I think that's something that a lot of listeners can probably really relate to. So do you want to tell us a bit about that? And I can only imagine, I mean, I'm guessing like learning how to be uncomfortable and deal with things and, you know, adjust your thoughts in your mind is super important when facing cancer. So
it is. And you make a good point with that. When I first developed cancer, it was 10 years ago. It was 2012. I was a girls' high school basketball coach when we were living in Texas, and I had a callus break open on the bottom of my foot. And initially I didn't think much of it because as a coach, you're on your feet a lot, but after it not healing for a few weeks, I made an appointment and went to see a podiatrist, a foot doctor, a friend of mine. And he took an x-ray and he said, "Terry, I think you have a little cyst in there and I can cut it out." And he did. And he showed it to me. It was just a little gelatin sac with some white fat in it. No dark spots, no blood, nothing that gave either one of us concern. But fortunately or unfortunately, he sent it off to pathology to have it looked at. And then 2 weeks later, I received a call from him. And as I mentioned, he was a friend of mine. And the more difficulty he was having explaining what was going on, the more frightened I was becoming. Until finally, he just laid it out for me. He said, "Terry, I've been a doctor for 25 years. I have never seen this form of cancer. You have a rare form of melanoma that appears on the bottom of the feet or the palms of the hands. And because your cancer is so incredibly rare, he recommended I go to MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, which is, if not the best, certainly one of the best cancer hospitals in the world,
right,
to be treated." And so I did. I had surgery to remove the tumor on the bottom of my foot. I had another surgery to remove all the lymph nodes in my groin. And when I healed, my doctor put me on a weekly injection of a drug called interferon to help keep the disease from coming back. The side effects of interferon were that it gave me severe flu-like symptoms for 2 to 3 days every week after each injection. Wow. And I took those weekly injections for almost 5 years. So imagine having the flu every week for 5 years. And as my doctor said, that's not a cure. She used to call it kicking the can down the road. We're just hoping to buy you more time for more therapies to come available. I was on the interferon for 5 years, as I mentioned, had to stop it in 2017 when it became so toxic to my body that I ended up in the intensive care unit with a fever of 108 degrees, which is usually not compatible with being alive. And almost immediately after stopping the interferon, the cancer came back in the exact same spot on my foot where it had presented 5 years earlier. And that necessitated in 2018, the amputation of my left foot. Cancer worked its way up my leg into my shin in 2019, two more surgeries. And then 2020, an undiagnosed tumor kind of in my ankle area, the lower part of what was left of my leg, grew large enough that it fractured my tibia, my shin bone. And my only recourse right in the middle of the COVID pandemic was to have my left leg amputated. And I also found out I had tumors in my lungs, which I'm still being treated for. So I know that sounds like a very ugly and dark journey, and it certainly has been. But I'll say this, cancer has made me a better human being.
Yeah. So first of all, how did you manage your thoughts when you got this initial diagnosis and as you were going through these different steps? Because that's something I think every person who's ever had cancer can relate to. The thoughts that come into mind of like, oh my gosh, you know, number one, am I going to die? Like all of the different things that one goes through. And I can relate to this. I am also a cancer survivor. So, I would love to hear what you battled with and how you quieted your mind.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, obviously if you've been through this, you understand this probably better than people who haven't. I think when I was first diagnosed, when I first found out I had cancer, I went through all the stages that we would probably associate with grief. You know, first it was denial. It's like, well, this can't possibly be. I've done everything right in my life. You know, I've been an athlete. I've eaten right. I haven't abused alcohol and drugs. I exercise, you know, I did all that. And then, you know, you kind of get mad. And it's like, wait a minute, I did do everything right. How can I possibly have this disease? You know, and then you sort of bargain with God, you know, kind of like, hey, you know, my daughter was in high school. Could you let me live long enough to see her graduate from high school? And then you, I think, get down a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then I think you sort of come out the other end and you realize that this sucks, but you have to embrace that suck. That these are the cards that you've been dealt. You don't like the cards, but you have to play this hand to the best of your ability. And that's what I've done for the last 10 years. Sometimes successfully, sometimes not. I mean, you're looking at me right now. There's no S on my chest. I don't have a cape and fly around with magical powers. I have bad days. I cry. I get down. I feel sorry for myself. I just don't let myself stay in those places because they're not good. Nothing good ever comes out of that. So, I mean, part of that is really dealing with your mind, as I said, because your mind is putting all these thoughts into your brain. Like you said, you know, am I going to die? You know, is this going to hurt? How bad is all this going to be and stuff like that? So you really, when I was growing up, there was a basketball coach at Indiana University by the name of Bobby Knight. And Bobby Knight had a great saying. He said, mental is to physical as 4 is to 1. So here was this great coach teaching premier athletes how to use their bodies to be great basketball players on the court. Right. But what he was really saying with that quote is that your mind or your mindset is 4 times more important than anything your physical body is going to do.
So what specifically do you have specific exercises that you do, or what do you do when you're having a bad day? Or when you're looking at, you know, so when you got your next level of diagnosis and you're like, oh goodness, what's going on here? What are the steps you take?
So whenever I get into those places, I do a couple of things. One, I remember a story that I read about, and this story, you know, first when I read about it, I thought, no, there's no way. And I've done some research in it. I have not found anything that is contradicted this story that says it didn't happen. So I'm going to assume that it did. And it sort of makes sense. It's a pretty simple story. It's about a professor back in the 1950s at Johns Hopkins University. And he performed an experiment. It was a very simple experiment. And hang with me here because I'm going to talk about rats here for a minute.
That's okay.
He took rats and he put them in a tank of water that was over their head. And he wanted to see how long the average rat could tread water before it would sink and drown. And the average rat treaded water for about 15 minutes. And just as the rats were getting ready to drown, he reached in, grabbed them, pulled them out, dried them off, let them rest for a while. And then he took the exact same rats and put them in the exact same tank of water. And the second time around, those rats, on average, treaded water for 60 hours. So think about that. The first time, 15 minutes. 15 minutes. I'm just not going to fail. I'm going to die. I mean, I'm not going to be able to, you know, to breathe. I'm going to sink and drown. The second time around, 60 hours, which said to me 2 things. Number one, the importance of hope in our lives. We have to believe that maybe not today, maybe not next month, maybe not even next year, but at some point down the road, our life will get better. You know, something, you know, even if we pass away, even if we die, our life will be better. And so hope was incredibly important. And the second thing I learned was just how much more our physical bodies can handle than we ever thought they could. Now, I thoroughly believe that everybody has a breaking point, but I really believe that breaking point is so much farther down the road than we ever thought it would be. And my wife works with a young man who's a former Navy SEAL, some of the toughest men in the world. And the SEALs talk about their 40% rule, which basically says that if you're done, if you're, you know, at the end of your rope, if you can't go on with whatever you're doing, according to the SEALs, you're only at 40% of your maximum and you still have another 60% left in reserve to give to yourself. So whenever I get into those places, I remember those, you know, those stories. And the other thing I do is, you know, when we're down, when we're depressed, when we're feeling sorry for ourselves, we're looking internally. It's all about us. Oh, woe is me. You know, this is really bad. What I found a way to do that is to look externally. Who can I help? Who can I make a difference in their lives? Who can I pick up the phone and call and say, how's it going? Now, all of a sudden, I'm projecting things outwardly and I'm not thinking about myself. And all of a sudden, I start to feel better. So I go every 3 weeks to have treatment for the tumors in my lungs. I can always find somebody who's worse off than I am, you know, who needs a pat on the back, who needs, hey, let's have a cup of coffee, let's talk, whatever it is. So find somebody who's worse off than you. And all of a sudden, now you're not looking internally, you're looking externally, and you feel a whole lot better.
That's a great method. So what about if you're just feeling so awful that you don't have the energy to pick up the phone? What do you do in that scenario?
And I felt that way during when I was going through those 5 years of interferon.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I was so sick of being sick. Yeah. That I literally prayed to die. I'm like, I can't deal with this. And I did deal with it. I mean, I found a way. And you know, you always want to win the day. I mean, you probably heard that saying. People say, you know, I want to win the day. Well, sometimes winning the day is I got to win this 5 minutes. That's all I got to do. I mean, for me with interferon, it was I got to get out of bed and I got to make it to the couch. That's winning the day. That's all I can do. I feel so lousy. I feel so sick. That's the best I can do today.
Yeah.
And that's okay. I mean, we all think, you know, we got to be Superman. You don't have to be Superman. Right. Do the best you can with what you have today with the realization that you're going to have to do it again tomorrow. I mean, tomorrow may be better. Tomorrow may not be better. Tomorrow you may have to get that mental resolve going. And one of the things I try to do every day of my life, and I will recommend this to your audience, is do one thing that makes you nervous, that makes you uncomfortable, that scares you, that is potentially embarrassing. It doesn't have to be a big thing. It can be something small. But if you do those small things every day, when the big disasters in life hit us, and they hit all of us, as you know, you end up losing your job, you end up finding out you have some kind of an illness, you know, whatever it ends up being, they hit all of us. If you do those small things every day, you'll be so much more resilient when the big things in life come our way.
Right. That's what I was just going to say, is like great way to just build up that resilience. So like, I can do it. I can do it. I can do it. So tell me about when you knew you were going to lose your leg. How did you go through that process? Was it also going through the stages of grief? Like, do you let yourself vent the anger? How do you approach all of that?
Yeah, it was a very short period of time. I was having swelling in my kind of calf area, and my doctor had sent me to an occupational therapist to try to get the edema, to get the fluid out of my leg. And what she was doing wasn't working. And finally, she called the doctor and she's like, something's not right here. You need to scan him. Uh-huh. And they scanned me and found out my entire lower leg was just full of cancer. So I have this scan at, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning. By 5 o'clock that night, one, I find out I'm going to have my leg amputated above the knee. And two, I've got these large tumors in my lungs. And I was like, wait a minute. And literally 4 days later, I had my leg amputated. I mean, I didn't have a lot of time to sort of process this.
Right.
And I remember, you know, people always ask me, like, what do you think about the night before you're going to have your foot amputated, the night before you're going to have your leg amputated? And I may be weird. I don't know what other people think about, but I kept thinking about D-Day in World War II. I kept thinking about the young men and women that were on those boats off the shore of Normandy, France, you know, in June, that were like, many of them were going to be mowed down. Many of them were going to give their life, but they were going to give their life for something that was bigger than themselves. And I think that's one thing I've learned. And I think I learned it through team sports. You know, like I said, I started playing basketball when I was 9 years old and played all the way up until I graduated from college. And I think one of the things that team sports teaches you is the importance of being part of something that's bigger than yourself. You realize that on a team, that if you don't do your job, not only do you let yourself down, but you let your teammates down, your coaches down, your fans down, et cetera. And if you think about it, the biggest team game that we all play is this game of life. So, I don't even remember. I mean, it was during COVID. My doctor took me to a hospital where I'm in Colorado right now. So I'm part of the University of Colorado health system.
Okay.
We did not go to the main campus. We went to an outlying hospital that did not accept COVID patients.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, my doctor was great. The downside of it was my wife dropped me off at the hospital. I was not allowed to have anyone with me.
Right.
I was put in a wheelchair. I was wheeled back to the pre-op room or area, you know, which is just cubicle after cubicle. I was the only person there. I mean, I was the only person who's having surgery that day. My doctor had to get special permission to actually perform the surgery. Uh-huh. I was supposed to be in the hospital for a week to learn, you know, how to maneuver without a leg and stuff like that. My doctor's like, nope, you're in the hospital for 48 hours. Make sure those therapists teach you everything they possibly can in 48 hours. And my therapists were like pulling their hair out. Like, we need more time. It's like, well, you got 48 hours and I'm getting out of here. So it was, it was just something that, I mean, I look back on it now and I think you can probably understand this. Cancer or any kind of a chronic or a terminal illness tends to isolate you. It isolates you from your friends. It isolates you from your family. Sometimes it even isolates you from yourself. Uh-huh. And, you know, I really felt isolated at that time. Like I said, you know, my wife, she was like, what am I supposed to do? I said, I don't know, hon. I said, go park in the parking lot and wait till the doctor. I mean, I was having my leg cut off. So it wasn't like a 20-minute procedure.
Right.
I mean, it was several hours. And I said, he'll call you, you know, and let you know what's going on and stuff. But you, I mean, there's that hopelessness on your family's part of, I can't help you. I can't even be with you and hold your hand. You just got to deal with this. And that's the, instead of running from pain, you know, I talked about it before, you know, our brains are hardwired to avoid pain and discomfort. Well, think about it the other way. What if you didn't run from pain? What if you took pain and flipped it inside and burned it as fuel and used it as energy to make you stronger, to make you tougher, to make you more resilient? People don't do that. They want to get away from pain. I mean, we know that. I mean, people are like, hey, you know what? I'm going through pain. I'm going to medicate myself. You know, I'm going to do alcohol. I'm going to do drugs. I'm going to do behavior that isn't good for me. We see it all the time.
Right.
What if you did the opposite? What if you just took that pain and said, I can handle this? Because like I said, we all have a breaking point, but that breaking point is so much farther down the road than we ever thought it was.
That's amazing. I mean, you have incredible mental discipline to be able to have such a drastic thing happen and then just kind of process that and go forward. What did you do in your most difficult moments?
Prayed.
Okay.
I mean, I talk a lot about what has gotten me through cancer and I talk about my three F's, which are faith, family, and friends. And, you know, we're great, especially here in the United States. You know, we'll start down the road toward a goal or something we want to do. And then we run into an impediment. Something gets in our way and we can't get over it or around it or through it. So we quit. But we don't just quit. We got to blame somebody. You know, we got to find somebody to blame. I got to blame my parents or my boss or my station in life. Very few people take personal responsibility for their own success and happiness. And so, you know, here I am. Okay. People believe, you know, they're like, who do you blame for your getting cancer? I'm like, what do you mean? Who do I blame?
Yeah.
Like, I don't blame anybody. And then they find out I have a faith life and they're like, well, you must blame God. And I sort of joke. I'm like, no, I don't think God got up on a Tuesday morning, checked his to-do list and said, Terry Tucker, cancer today. Like, I don't think that at all. But I think what God did was give me the strength, the courage. Those days when I was on interferon, where I was praying, just take me, get me out of here. I'm tired of being sick. No, you're going to stay and you're going to continue to do what I want you to do. And I remember several months ago, my doctor showed me my CAT scan back in 2020 when, you know, I was having my leg amputated, but I also had these large tumors in my lungs. And I have no medical background, so I don't really know how to read a CAT scan, but I kind of know what it doesn't look like it should be there. And I remember seeing these big tumors and I had fluid all around the pleural spaces of my lungs. And I remember looking at them and I was like, how was I alive? Yeah. And he kind of got this grin on his face and started shaking his head. And he's like, I don't know. Which said to me that God's not done with me yet. You know, when I die, how I die, where I die, way above my pay grade. So I don't spend a lot of time worrying about it. And so, you know, that's the faith part. The family part, as I mentioned, it's just my wife and daughter and I. When I finished having my leg amputated, my doctor wanted to put me on chemotherapy. And again, I looked at him and was like, is it going to save my life? He's like, yeah, probably not, but it may buy you some more time. And I was like, well, I'm 8 years into this fight. Do I want to go through all that ugliness with the outcome going to be the same anyway? I said, but I'll go home and talk to my family. And this is kind of a funny story. So I go home and I start telling my wife and daughter what's going on. And my daughter's immediately, all right, we need a family meeting. I'm like, family meeting? There's three of us. It's not like we got a board here or something like that, you know? So we all sit around the kitchen table and give our different perspectives of me having chemotherapy. And then my daughter is like, all right, let's take a vote. How many people want dad to have chemotherapy? And my wife and daughter raised their hand. I'm like, wait a minute. Am I getting outvoted for something that I don't want to do? But I remember back when I was in the police academy, our defensive tactics instructor used to have us bring a photograph of the people we love the most to class. And as we were learning to defend ourselves, we were to look at that photograph because he reasoned you will fight harder for the people you love than you will fight for yourself. So I took chemotherapy, not because I wanted to, but because I love my family more than I love myself. And in hindsight, it was a great bridge to the clinical trial drug that I'm on right now. Whereas if I hadn't taken it, there's no doubt I wouldn't be here right now.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's amazing. Well, this has been so interesting, Terry. If there's one thing a couple things that you'd like to leave our audience with, what would those be?
Let me leave you with a story, if I may.
Absolutely.
I've always been a big fan of Westerns growing up. You know, when I was young, my mom and dad used to let me stay up late and watch Gunsmoke and Bonanza and Wild Wild West. And I'm sure your audience is like, what's he talking about? Those shows aren't on TV anymore. 1993, the movie Tombstone came out. You may have seen it. It was a huge blockbuster. It's still being shown on reruns now. It starred Val Kilmer as a man by the name of John Doc Holliday and Kurt Russell as a man by the name of Wyatt Earp. Now, Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp were two living, breathing human beings who walked on the face of the earth. They're not made up characters just for the movie. Now, Doc was called Doc because he was a dentist by trade, but pretty much Doc Holliday was a gunslinger and a card shark. Uh-huh. And Wyatt Earp had been some form of a lawman his entire adult life. And somehow these two men from entirely opposite backgrounds come together and form this very close friendship. And at the end of the movie, Doc Holliday is dying at a sanitarium in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, which is about 3 hours from where I live. The real Doc Holliday died at that sanitarium and he's buried in the Glenwood Springs Cemetery.
Oh, interesting.
And Wyatt at this point in his life is destitute. He has no money, he has no job, he has no prospects for a job. So every day he comes to play cards with Doc and the two men pass the time that way. And then this almost last scene in the movie, the two men are talking about what they want out of life. And Doc says, you know, I was in love with my cousin when I was younger, but she joined a convent over the affair, but she's all that I ever wanted. And then he looks at Wyatt and he says, what about you, Wyatt? What do you want? And Wyatt kind of nonchalantly says, I just want to lead a normal life. And Doc looks at him and says, there's no normal. There's just life. And get on with living yours. You know, Maria, you and I both know probably people out there that are sitting back and be like, well, when this happens, I'll have a normal life. Or when this occurs, I'll have a successful life. Or when this arises, I'll have a significant life. What I'd like to leave your audience with is this. Don't wait. Don't wait for life to come to you. Get out there, find the reason you were put on the face of this earth, use your unique gifts and talents and live that reason. Because if you do, at the end of your life, I'm going to promise you two things. Number one, you're going to be a whole lot happier. And number two, you're going to have a whole lot more peace in your heart.
I think that is so beautiful. And I'm going to stop us there because that's so perfect. For everyone who happens to be watching on video, we're showing Terry's website and book. And for everyone else, this will all be in the podcast notes. Terry, thank you so much for joining me today and for everything that you've shared. And I wish you the very best on your cancer journey. And thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Maria. I appreciate it.
Okay. Yeah. Bye. Okay, everyone, have a great week. See you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. If you found this content helpful, please like, comment, and share across your social media. Are you sick of MindCluck clucking up your days? Book a free initial consult with me at mindcluck.com and let's silence it. Thanks and have a great week.